This talk will be about starting an open source business. Please welcome Paul Fenwick, who already started his business with Pearl Training Australia. Please welcome him.
Thank you very much. Just a few things before I start. Can everybody hear me? Is the microphone working okay? Lots of thumbs up? Fantastic. Also, a couple of other things. I ask that if you can, questions be held until the end. There will be time for questions. And also, if you have a mobile phone, consider turning it to silent. If you've got a very groovy ringtone, I'll dance to it. It'll be embarrassing for both of us. So now, I'm going to be talking about how to start a business. And the original title for this talk was So You Want to Start a Business. And I rapidly realized it's a pretty dumb title for a talk, because anybody can start a business. It's really, really easy to start one. You fill in a couple of forms and you're done. The most important thing is that you want to start a successful business, one that makes you money rather than losing you money, because losing your money is kind of not the point. And of course, being at an open source conference, as we are, we want to be starting an open source business. And most talks at about this stage will tell you that everything's happy and sunny and there are cute fluffy clouds and everything's sweetness and light and hugs. But that's not really a good representation of what it's like to start an open source business in Australia. A much better representation would be this. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Now, I want to define up front which hell I'm going to be discussing. I'm not going to be talking about moonlighting, where you're doing things in your spare time, and I'm not going to be talking about big business either, where you start off with a big wodge of venture capital or something. What I really want to be talking about is open source consultancy. Where you have a small business and you're working with open source. You don't have to be writing open source code, although that can certainly help. You might be doing things like system administration on open source systems. You might be doing support or installation or configuration. In our case, I do training. I teach people how to use Perl. And all of our course notes are available online. End plug. If you're selling free and open source software, if you're trying to convince your clients to use it, you'll discover that most customers actually don't care. They don't care about open source, but they don't care about proprietary systems either. Really, what they care about is getting the job done. They've got a problem, they need it solved. Now, this actually makes FOSS really easy to pitch, particularly to small and medium businesses who don't care so much about having somebody to sue. Really, the wonderful thing about FOSS, low upfront costs. It means it's very easy to take a system, to install it, and try it out, see if it meets the bill. The most important thing I find for convincing people is that it provides insurance against the arch enemy of IT professionals everywhere, the bus being hit by one. Because somebody else can come in and take your work. They can be on the other side of the world. So why might you want to start a business? Well, you might say, oh, I saw this great talk at a conference. I'm going to start my own business. Believe it or not, doing things because conference presenters tell you, that's a bad idea. Hate to break it to you. Somebody says, hey, do this. No, bad idea. Most businesses crash, and they crash horribly and dramatically in the first couple of years. So you don't want to be starting a business just because it seems like fun or it sounded like a good idea at the time. A better reason to start a business is it gives you a bit more control over your destiny. I found myself very frustrated in a real job, and so this is why I started a business. For me, it was all about choices and lifestyle. I want to live in this particular way. I want to work on these particular things, and I'll discuss that in this talk. A lot of people start a business because they want more time, or they want more money, or they want more of both. Do be careful. You can end up finding yourself with less of both if you're not careful. Now, my very, very first business actually started by accident. It was more than 10 years ago. I was a starving student role-playing computer geek. I had very, very typical and expensive hobbies for the time. I don't know if anybody remembers this. Few of you do. We used to call it cardboard crack. That was one of my hobbies. My other hobbies included anime. I loved anime. I was really big into games of all sorts, especially role-playing games. And beer. Beer was very important as a student, and I needed money for it. Really, my first business started because I needed money to support these hobbies. I needed a way to pay for my beer. So I had these friends in IT, and I started doing odd jobs for them. And those odd jobs, a little bit of HTML here, a little bit of C there, they're all done under Linux, which was really, really cool. And I didn't get paid very much for them, but they paid the bills. I also learned this thing called Perl for this newfangled invention called the World Wide Web that I didn't think was going to go anywhere, but I was very wrong. And what I discovered is I'd started my own business. That really I was taking on contracts, I was doing those contracts, I was getting new clients even, and I was running my own business. The other thing at the time is that I was working as a casual tutor for the University of Melbourne, and I loved to teach. I was helping people with first and second year comp sci. It was really, really enjoyable. I didn't get paid much for that either. But I got enough for my hobbies, but not enough to live on. That's what my parents were for. Eventually, I graduated. My parents figured out that I didn't have to go to university and drink beer every day. So I took on a real job in order to support myself. First of all, at the university, then out in private industry. What I discovered? Having a real job sucked. Didn't enjoy it. There were long hours. I actually had to turn up to work every day, work for 8 hours, sometimes longer. And there were commute times. I had to get to work and from work. I couldn't just do everything from my lounge room. It sucked. And the work I was doing, I wasn't that interested in. Some of it was really interesting, some of it not so. And every time I started to get into something interesting, there'd be a deadline on one of the boring pieces of work. I'd have to go back to that. The real clincher for me, I wasn't learning enough. I really wanted to learn new skills, new technologies, play with new things. I didn't have the chance to do so when every day I was working and commuting and sleeping sometimes. So I started looking around. Is there any way I can get by without actually having a real job? Well, I looked at some of my friends who were doing consulting, the ones who had thrown me bits of work back in my student days. I said, wow, they're earning $100 an hour. And I did the maths. I said, if I want to earn $50,000 a year, which I thought was a reasonable amount of money to get me by, it's 500 hours a year, 10 hours a week, 2 hours per business day. I can work 2 hours per business day and get 50 grand a year. Woot. So I did that. I quit my job. I said, I've got this fantastic idea. I'm going to become a consultant. And my neighbours actually thought the same thing. I started business with friends, and we decided we were going to go into consulting together and work 2 hours a day. And I felt very comfortable about this because I knew that my savings would last for years. How did I know that? No, I'm serious. How did I know my savings would last for years? Well, I'm going to try and teach you something now. It has to do with money. I'd spent the last year doing personal accounting. I'd kept track of all of my income, all of my expenses, all of my assets and all of my liabilities. Now, I did that with GNU Cash, which some of you may have used. I used GNU Cash because it's what I was working on at the time. It was one of my projects I was interested in. But there are lots of different packages out there. Start doing this now if you're thinking of starting up a business, because it really helps to know your financial situation. And it tends to be useful. That was an interesting slip. Tends to be useful even if you don't start a business. It's nice to know where the money's coming from, where it's going to, what you're spending it on. It made tax time easier. That wasn't the big advantage for me. The big advantage was profiling expenses. I knew exactly what I was spending money on, how much the beer and magic cards were costing me. And it meant that I knew where my money was coming from as well. And what happens if I don't get any more income? What happens if my expenses change like this? So I could figure out how long my savings would last. And that was very important. So you want to be financially prepared. One of the reasons is because if you're starting a business, there are lots of startup costs. As soon as you start a business, everything starts being tax deductible. So you want to get your ADSL 2 Plus connection. You want to get your fast machine with the quad graphics cards and the dual 24-inch LCD monitors, because they're all tax deductible now. You've got to have them. Unfortunately, you start off with very little income. Because even if you have work from day one, clients giving you money from day one, it's still going to be probably a month before you can invoice them, and then probably a month before they realize that you've invoiced them, and probably a month after that before they pay you. But that's actually not why you need the money. The big reason why you need the money is because starting your business is scary. In particular, watching your savings dwindle away is very, very scary. If you find yourself at a point where you say, gee, I've got to find some money soon, otherwise I won't be able to eat, you can get scared back to a real job. Now, if that happens in the first month or two of you having your business, then really you can be scared back and you've failed. Because your business may have succeeded if you allowed it to keep going, if you allowed yourself to collect clients and reputation and work, but you haven't. So you've ended up wasting your time and money. by trying a business that didn't succeed. It would have been better if you went on holidays. You would have enjoyed it more. It's much, much better to start with oodles of cash. The bigger the pile of cash you have, the longer you can try and allow your business to succeed. The downside is if your business doesn't succeed, you've just blown heaps of time and money on it. So do try and figure out if it's been like 2 years, you still haven't made anything, it's probably a good time to stop. Now, as I said, I did go into business with friends and it was great. It was fantastic. We had business meetings by the pool. We did design by the barbecue. We all brewed beer together. We're all into homebrew. And we drank our beer, playing network games and watching anime in the evenings. So it was pretty much what I wanted in a job. The only downside is that I was having a bit too much fun to do any work. So I was glad that I had my savings available. One of the things with the business, it focused on consulting. I said, I want to be a consultant. They said, we want to be consultants. We all do consulting together. What I discovered very quickly, however, is that I didn't want to do consulting. I wanted to teach. What I really, really enjoyed doing was the teaching. Back when I was a student, I was doing tutoring. That's what I wanted to do, preferably in Perl. Perl was my language of choice. And I actually found a client. They wanted 2 weeks' worth of teaching. And that wasn't the problem. The problem was that we actually had internal disagreements in the business on how that money should be distributed. That was bad, very, very bad. What happened is we had irreconcilable, intractable differences of opinion. We simply could not agree. And what happened is we lost our friendship because of it. And that hurts, it really, really sucked. So if you do go into business with friends, do be very, very careful. Not only can you lose time and money, you can also lose your friendships as well. And even if you think it's never going to happen, I thought there's no way that our friendship could be hurt by this. It did, and it was bad. So be careful. So the result of all that, I started Perl Training Australia, which is still running today and is my primary work. I'll be talking a bit about that later on. The other thing is that when I was working, when I was both working as a consultant and in Perl Training Australia, I got money. But where did that work and money come from? Well, I had contacts. I had contacts from my university days. I was well known in the comp sci department, so I knew people there. I had contacts from back when I was in a real job. If you leave a job, try to stay on good terms with the people there, because they may give you work later on. In my case, they hired me back as a consultant for heaps more money. And I had contacts from my contacts as well. This was probably the most valuable of all. My contacts telling their clients and friends and associates, oh, there's this guy called Paul. He actually has a clue or two. And these are what gave me work. So most of your work ends up coming from these contacts. They come from word of mouth. And this is a good thing. When you're starting a business, word of mouth is cheap advertising. You might have to buy people a beer or two. Or if you do homebrew, you might give them a beer or two. But it's cheap advertising. The more contacts you have, the more work you have available, which means the more money you can make or the more options you have as to what work you do, which is a very good thing. But how do you get those contacts? You know, are they hard to find? Well, oops. Well, you want to network. Your potential contacts are right here. They're in the room with you right now. You're at a conference with technical professionals. So talk to everyone. Tell them what you do. In particular, tell them your skills. Don't just say, I'm a system administrator. Say, I'm a system administrator and I specialize on these particular systems. And here are some of the cool things which I've done with them. Because sometimes people out there are after particular skills. And it's easier to remember that, this person is a specialist in this field. Oops. Give them business cards. Now, a lot of people don't care about business cards, but you'll find that non-technical people, which amazingly make up a lot of your client base, do care about business cards. The other thing is they're pretty fail-safe. You don't have to worry about batteries, you don't have to worry about protocols, you don't have to worry about Bluetooth. It's a piece of paper. They're easy to transfer. And start doing this now. Even if you don't have the business cards, try to build up your contacts because they can be useful, again, even if you don't happen to start a business. You might find somebody who's very cool who can help you in some other way. So it's good to know people. They might help you find a real job. The most important asset of all is not money and it's not contacts. It's more important than all of those. So we need them, but there's something more important. How about talent? Well, talent is actually optional. You don't need to have talent to start a real business. There's something more important than talent. It's much scarier. It's called social skills. What scares the hell out of me? Took me ages to figure that one out. Because a lot of your clients aren't going to be geeks. They're going to be normal people. The internet's broken. Fix it. I don't know how to do that. I've got a separate talk, actually, on how to interface with them. I found that social skills were the key to business success, the absolute key. And the reason is that your client can't tell if you're writing good code. They can't tell if you're doing a good job of looking after their systems, unless they're on fire. They can't tell if you've done a good job of designing their network. What they can tell is if you're communicating effectively. If you're telling them, oh, you know, I've got this problem over here and here's how I'm going to solve it. Or we're doing things in this way because it's going to make this easier later on. Or I found this opportunity which we might want to pursue. So if you've got two people, one who's got no talent but effective communication, another person who's brilliant but sits in the corner and never talks, the person who's talking will get the business because the clients see the talking, not the work. The absolute golden rule of social skills, if you're doing anything with anyone really, make people feel good about themselves. Really, make them feel good. Most people sort of get this idea, it's nice to have other people happy, but they don't practice it. Unless it actually causes you honest hardship, either financial hardship or in some other way, be polite, appreciate others, and do not be insulting. Get creative. If somebody comes to you with their homegrown code and says, oh, I've got a bit of a problem with this, can you help me out? And it's the worst code you've ever seen. Don't say, this code sucks. Say, wow, that's really novel. I'd never have thought of doing it that way. Can all of my clients please leave the room at this point? Never thought of doing it that way, but how about we try this, see if that works. So be creative. On that note, you'll be dealing with clients, and I found that most of my clients, again, were small and medium businesses because of the word of mouth thing, and that's where word of mouth really works. They appreciate personalized service. Rather than dealing with a big business where they could be dealing with a different person every time, they're always going to be dealing with you. They like that. In particular, they like that at 2 a.m. on a Sunday. When something's gone wrong and they've got your mobile number, they give you a call. And they'll find you through word of mouth. So make sure you keep people happy. They'll talk and tell other people about you. Types of clients. You'll find that every client is different. I will try and categorize them into groups later on, but everyone is unique. They'll all have different needs. They'll all have different expectations. What one client loves, another client will hate. So you're going to have to learn them on a case-by-case basis. Some of them are great to work with. Some of them are fantastic. Some of them are more novel. But they produce the most work. And that's not too surprising. They're the ones who have the most difficulties. They produce the most work. Your ideal clients, the ones you like to work for, they tend to be really clueful. They tend to be very well-resourced. They tend to know what they're doing. Why are you working for them? Well, ideally, it's for your specialist skills. We know that you wrote this program or this system or this module or this piece of code, and we think it's fantastic. And we would like you to add these features to it. Well, that's fantastic. You get to work on stuff that you love anyway, but you get paid for it. It's awesome. It's interesting and enjoyable work. The downside is you don't get too much of it. Because they're so clueful and well-resourced, once you've added those features or helped them out, they can take it from there. They don't need you on a day-by-day basis. So keep calling them. Make sure they know that they're loved and appreciated. They might call you back to do more things. Your innovative clients, your special clients, tend to be more disorganized. They have different ways of running the system. And they tend to be technically skill impaired. We want to be nice about this. And that's okay, because they may not be a technical business. They may be doing something else. They may be doing retail or sales or anything else. They may be technically inclined, but they may not. They may actually need full-time staff. I've had a number of clients who have had dozens of machines and no system administrator to look after them. And I kept telling them, you really need to have a system administrator. But for some reason, they don't have one. Either they're too cheap or they love you too much to hire a sysadmin. The problem with this, everything's always an emergency. Because there's nobody there actually looking after the systems. When something goes wrong, it's a big break. You know, a disk fills up, things fall over, a machine catches on fire, whatever happens, the backup tapes are all corrupt. It's an emergency, and that's bad. I recommend that you make sure you have penalty rates organized beforehand. Emergencies tend to happen at all times, the day and night, on holidays, public holidays, any other time. So make sure that if they are going to call you up at an inconvenient time, you get paid extra money because of that. The other type of client that I've encountered are intermediary clients. Now, these are ones where they want you to do work for their client. And these can be really wonderful. They can be really, really good because they can handle the dull things. They can do the invoicing. They can do the management. They can do the client liaison. They can do specs and scoping. There's almost nothing more wonderful than somebody coming to you saying, here is a complete software requirement specification and a test plan. We want you to implement it. It's wonderful. So intermediary clients can be really, really good if you find a good one. The downside, they can be special as well. You can get poor specifications and scope. You can get a piece of paper drawn in crayon with a big sort of fluffy cloud with internet marked on it and a box. You have no idea how many of these I've seen. They say, we want to implement this. And you say, what, the internet or the box? And they say, oh, we're not sure, we've got to go back to the client. So, problem is, you may not have access to that end client. Some of these people say, no, I'm doing the work, and the fact that you happen to be there in a back room, they want to hide you. The client's not allowed to see you, which means that if you ask questions, they may not get answered. If you say, what's the situation on that box over there, because it looks like it's on fire, you might actually get answers on that box over there, which isn't on fire, and it could take days to get it. And this can be very, very hard. The worst thing with these clients, sometimes you get this. You get paid when we get paid, but you've got no access to the end client, which means you have no way of controlling when they pay. I really recommend that you don't put up with this unless you are starving. Any business that's doing things properly should have enough capital to make sure that it can pay you on time. And it's illegal in New Zealand. So if you want to start a business like this, don't go to New Zealand. Do it here. Now, if you're wondering what sort of client you have, are they a good client? Are they an innovative client? You've really got to wonder. Unfortunately, you can discover too late. To begin with, they can all look the same. You know, you have some meetings, you have some beers, they look like they're nice people, you talk about some specs. One day they call you up at 2 a.m, but it was a legitimate emergency. That's okay. 2 weeks later, they call you up in the morning again. It was less of an emergency. You go, oh, this is not a good trend. By that stage, it's too late, because what's happened is you already have an agreement. It's not necessarily a written agreement that you've written down, but they've called you twice at 2 a.m, they got a response at that time, they're going to expect that's going to keep on happening. All of a sudden, they've become a client you don't necessarily want, unless they're paying you scads of money. There is a really, really good solution to this. Look around the room. The people in the room here may actually start their own business or may be starting their own business. Find those people and hand them those clients. When they come to you and say, oh man, you know, I've got a bit of free time. Do you know anyone who's, you know, doing any Linux sysadmin? You say, yes, I've got a client here who really would appreciate your services. Hand them over. Everyone's happy. Now, on that note, you'll find that there is a wide spectrum of work that you might find yourself doing. And the very best work has good closure. Now, by good closure, if you think of those cheesy blockbusters, there's one that we had a few years ago, The Core. But anyone where the Earth is going to be destroyed and you have a group of heroes who need to save it and they plug up the volcano or they get the Earth's core spinning or they destroy the asteroid and then they're all done. The Earth is saved, they go home, the credits roll, they have a beer. Done. You don't see them filling out insurance forms. That's closure. And it's very, very satisfying. It's good to be able to say, okay, I can go to sleep. There's nothing more to be done. Unfortunately, most work doesn't fall into closure categories. Some tasks have no closure. A good example, system administration. Once you've set up a box, it needs to be maintained. Unless it's Minix 3, it's going to have failures. So you'll have to look after it. Software maintenance. If you write a program of any sort, even if your program is bug-free, which is never going to happen, the environment around it is going to change. The clients are going to change. I have software that I wrote 10 years ago, and clients still call me up about it, saying, oh, can we get this changed? We don't like the color orange anymore. We want it changed to pink. Those tasks may never ever end. And they can get quite frustrating because you might not like the task anymore. You might have something else you want to be doing. So why would you ever do them to begin with? Well, there's a very, very good reason. Money. Poor closure means good income stream. If you know the task is never going to end, it's going to keep on paying unless you really piss off your client or you get hit by a bus. So it's very, very important that you do have these tasks to begin with. And it means that you know where your next meal is coming from. Is that machine over there which is running out of disk space? Or is that one over there which has blown a drive in its RAID? Stability of income when you start a business is a very good thing. Now, when I started a business as a consultant, I said this. As a consultant, I can choose the work that I'm going to do. I'm only going to be doing training and really interesting Perl development, not all the other crappy stuff that you see. And yes, that was absolutely 100% correct. I could choose the work that I do. I could choose between work and starvation. Because what surprised me is that there wasn't this endless sea of really, really interesting work and training out there. Most of the work was fairly dull, and I had to eat, so I had to do it. Now, when you first start your business, you can't be too picky. When you get more clients and more reputation, you can be picky. You can say, nah, that sounds like it sucks, I'm not going to do it. But to begin with, you've got to pay the bills. The other thing is that I'd started this business called Perl Training Australia. And I know it's not obvious from the name because my clients didn't get this for years, but I actually wanted to teach. I wanted to train people. I know it's really hard to tell. But what I discovered is that my contacts were all in sysadmin and all in software development because that's what I was doing for most of my early career. And what that meant is I got sysadmin and development work, not teaching work. And the problem with this, I was too busy doing all of that work to grow the training side of the business. So I was stuck in this evil loop. I wanted to do training, but I didn't have time to grow the training business. The other problems with that, I was running a micro business. To begin with, it was just me, which meant I had to do everything. Management, accounting, advertising, liaison, tax affairs, insurance, banking, and all by myself. I didn't expect that I had to do all of those. Just thought I could go and code. That was a bit of a wake-up call. Now, this is rather ironic. I actually left full-time work because I wanted more time. One of the big reasons for me leaving, I wanted more time to be able to learn and do things myself. And I'd planned on only working 2 hours a day. I didn't plan on all those other things. But for the first year, when I was doing my business, I was doing... Oh, there's a bug there. 12 hours a day of work. I would get up in the morning, a client would be calling me at sunrise, and I would work for 12 hours a day, usually with lots and lots of interruptions. It was hard work. So 2 hours is not enough. At the start, I thought that I could do it, but really, one of the reasons it's a problem is that clients want their work done now. It's all very good to say, well, I'm going to plan things. I'm only going to work 2 hours a day or 4 hours a day. But when a client needs a system built, they need it built now. When they've got software that needs done, the software's already late by the time you get it. So they need to have it now. So I worked those 60 hours a week, and I said, that's okay. I'll take time off later. Once this job is finished, I'll go on holidays. Holidays. Unfortunately, clients need constant support. Once you've built their system, it needs looking after. You can't take holidays because they won't survive. You need to have somebody there looking after it. If you go on holidays for 3 weeks and the server room explodes on day two, your client's not very happy with you. They're not going to let you get away. The other problem is that I thought that consultants got paid heaps of money. My original 2 hours per day figure was assuming that that was the only work I was going to do. But it's not the case. It's only for billable hours, things you can actually chuck on an invoice. You can't easily charge for bookkeeping. In fact, you normally pay someone else to do that. Office tasks, generating and chasing invoices, clients suck at paying invoices. Travel time, sysadmin on your own systems, meeting with clients who never actually employ you, who spend some time saying, oh yeah, this looks great, but actually we don't need that system after all. So there's all sorts of things which waste your time or which you can't charge for. The other problem is that I've been talking about turning time into money. It's a pretty simple recipe. Spend time working for a client, gain money in return. That sounds very similar to something else, because it's a stupid way to run a business. It's just the same as spending all of your time working. It's like a real job. You just left a real job, so now you have a real job with extra paperwork. and tax packs, which are this thick that you've got to fill in. It's a bad way of running a business. Ideally, we'd like to make the money without spending the time. We want time, we want money, we want freedom, we don't want the work. Well, don't press that button. One way of doing this, recurring revenue. Things like hosting companies, for example, subscription services. You do a whole lot of work up front, and then each client you get after that is just a tiny little bit of extra work that leverages what you've got. Product sales are not a bad advantage there. You spend a lot of time in R&D, you've got a big upfront cost, but then you can go out and get other people to sell your product. In our case, it was training. The other way that you can solve this problem, employees. Employees are great because they do work for you. It's fantastic. They get paid, you get paid a bit of their time as well, and you have more time. And if you've got more time, you can do more work. Or alternatively, you can grow your business to do the things you want it to do. Or if you're really lucky, you can take a holiday. But there is a catch, and it's a big one. Hiring a new employee means more work in itself. And what this means is legal paperwork, office space, creating accounts, showing them the ropes. That last one's really important. When they first come into your business, they don't know about your clients, they don't know about your procedures, they don't know how things are done. So even if they're really smart, they've got lots of skills, they still need to be shown the ropes. They've still got to learn how everything is done. The wrong time to hire is when you're busy. If you find yourself saying, wow, I'm really, really, really busy, I've got no time for anything at all, I should get an employee, it's the wrong time. The reason is, that means more work. If you're already at 110% of capacity, and you hire an employee, you've got to find more capacity. It's not going to be there. And it's very easy to end up getting overloaded. And then everything crashes. You don't go anywhere, it's bad for your employee, it's bad for your clients, it's bad for everyone. So don't hire people when you're really, really busy, because it doesn't work. The right time to hire is when things are quiet. And this seems really, really counterintuitive. It feels very, very strange. I don't have enough work. I may be working at 70, 80% of capacity. Why would I hire somebody else? Well, it really requires a bit of foresight and planning to say in 3 months' time, there will be that work available. Or in 3 months' time, I will need that holiday. Or in 3 months' time, something else will happen. But the good thing about this is that it gives you a chance to build up your business at a more modest pace. It's hard for a small business though. If you're going from one person to two people, you've doubled the size of the number of people in your business, and that's very hard. With a big business, this is easier. 100 people to 101 people, there's lots of people to show them the ropes. The other difficulty which I encountered, and which I really didn't expect, has to do with large business and small business. In a very large business, everyone's got a box. Your finance workers are counting beans, your IT workers are creating bugs, your sales workers are drinking lattes and schmoozing with clients, but nobody does all of those things. They've all got their particular roles, and it's pretty clear, with some fuzziness, what they're doing. In a small business, you do everything. In a small business, you're doing sales, you're doing accounting, you're doing the coding, you're going to the bank, you're putting out the trash, you're brewing the beer, you're doing everything. There are no well-defined positions. So if somebody comes to your business and says, I just want to code, they're not going to react very well when they've got to go to the bank, or they've got to attend a client meeting, or they've got to do some advertising or something else. Not everybody reacts well to that. I call it small business shock. It's most common in people who have come out of large business and have gone to a small business. You don't see it very often with, say, university students. They don't know what to expect. If you find somebody who manages to survive this, who gets through the small business shock, keep them. They're very, 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 very valuable. In fact, they might be so valuable, you could consider them perfect. If they do everything, and they do everything well, how do you keep them? Because really, they could start their own business. If they've got all those skills, they could start their own business and probably make more money than working for you. They probably make more money than you do right now. So you want to keep them happy, so they stay with you. Most importantly, if your legal position allows, there's a surefire way of keeping things under control, which is what I did. I found the perfect employee, and I said, well, if she's going to start her own business, I might as well get half. if you can't marry them, spoil them. Actually, spoil them if you do marry them. That's very important. But spoil your employees. Find out what they like and give it to them. Be it network games, be it free lunches, be it homebrew, be it beer or pizza, whatever it happens to be, give it to them. A lot of people leave their jobs not because they don't feel they're getting paid enough, but because they don't feel they're getting enough appreciation. So make sure they know that they're appreciated. They'll stick around, whatever it takes. Hiring new people is incredibly expensive. You've got to go through the interview process, you've got to find the right person, and then once you've hired them, they might not even work out. You can spend lots of time and money doing this. So keep the people you have. They're very valuable. The other option, if you find yourself with too much work, is outsourcing. It's an alternative to employees. The downside of outsourcing, you've got to pay consulting rates, $100 an hour, because you're hiring a consultant. The advantage, you only need to pay them if you need them. So if you find yourself with this spike of work, which you know is only going to last a week or two, you can get somebody in who happens to be in a similar position to you, and you can hand them work. The nice thing is there are low overheads. You don't have to give them an office, you don't have to give them a salary, you don't have to give them a machine, you don't have to do the paperwork. They're doing all of that for all of that by themselves in their 2 hours of work each day. So in conclusion, if you are thinking of starting a business, to be successful, you need money, you need contacts, and you need to have the social skills, or somebody else with social skills who will go into business with you. Talent, unfortunately, is optional. I've seen lots of people out there with successful businesses who don't have much talent, but it's really good to have. Now, I don't actually have the best job in the world. I'm pretty happy with my position at the moment. I think that the very best job in the world probably goes to these people, Adam and Jamie of Mythbusters fame. I really envy what they do for a job. However, I do have a very, very nice office in my backyard. Everyone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for questions, Paul?
Yeah, we have some minutes because of a long lunch break.
Okay. Oh, before we do questions, there is a paper that goes with this talk which explains everything in the slides plus a whole lot more. You can find it at that URL. And if you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Now, questions?
Mine's a comment rather than a question. Having been in this for a number of years as well, know what you do, know what you don't do, and
yes,
build up relationships with people who do those. Don't try to do everything. Find other people who are also consultants, pass them the work. It may come back to you directly, or it may come back to you three or four hands down.
Very good advice. Got a question down here and a microphone?
I found one of the hardest things with clients is actually getting them to pay you.
Yes.
Any hints on that?
Any hints on getting clients to pay you was the question. If they're the innovative and novel clients, then one way that I can find is when they call you up with an emergency, you say, oh dear, that invoice which I sent you, that's now 3 weeks overdue. And I'm going to have a really hard time working until that's paid. And suddenly, bang, they're paid immediately. Most of the clients I find aren't not paying due to maliciousness. Usually it's incompetence. So you just keep asking them and they do pay eventually. Yes.
Push your rate up just a little bit and give them a 5% discount.
Very true.
Is some clients will take a discount and then pay you later.
We've had that as well, actually.
Yeah.
And that makes your accounting and everything else very hard.
I don't know how much it's appropriate to ask, but how do you find out how much to charge?
How do I find how much to charge? Is a very, very good question. What do I charge for my time? I started off, the $100 an hour figure which I showed around is where I started. I said, well, I've got a friend, they're a consultant, they charge $100 an hour, I'll try that as well. And as I discovered I got more and more work, I just kept pushing that value upwards. And eventually some clients stopped asking me for work. I went, okay, well, that's what I'll charge. And so I just kept on pushing up the price. The downside is clients don't like it when you try to put up the price. So you normally do it, or in my case, I only did it every 6 months or so. The big break for me was actually finding somebody else who could do a lot of the consulting for me and just handing the work to them in an almost wholesale fashion. So it didn't matter what I was charging, it was what they were charging instead.
You know, like when you hire some people, there's certain types of people who are very, very talented,
yes.
But motivation's a sticking point. With those kinds of people, do you kind of take them on as a bit of a charity case and think, I can change these people, I can get them motivated, or do you instantly kind of push them out the door because if, despite their enormous talent, they're just not hitting the deadlines, they're not making it happen?
Oh dear, that's a very hard question. The question was, if you have people who are very talented but not very motivated, what do you do? I actually try to find people who are very generalist. With a small business, generalist is a big win. And so if I can find people who are generalist and motivated, that's what I'm after. We don't actually have any employees anymore. We used to have employees, and now it's just Jacinta and myself as owners of the business. And that's actually a lifestyle decision. So I haven't had to worry about that. But my gut feeling would be that no, I would actually get somebody who was more motivated but less skilled, would be my inclination. Sorry? Talent is optional, yes. Like tying their shoelaces.
So actually, here's a general comment on that issue. Don't ever hire anyone with the intent that you're going to reform them. You hire someone for their strengths, not for their weaknesses. People generally know what their weaknesses are, and often they've been working on fixing them for a good chunk of their life. It's not your job to reform them through employment at your business. It's your job to help them do what they do well, and if they need support on the issues they have trouble with, then do what you can with that, but don't use the job to fix that.
Mm.
Do you attempt to exceed your customers' expectations?
Do I attempt to exceed my customers' expectations? Always. Always. Because then they go, oh, wow, we got this fantastic service we didn't expect. And they'll come back later. So, yes, I always try to exceed them.
Yeah, one good piece of advice I got when I started out on that point was overcharge and overdeliver is a much better strategy than undercharging and
yes.
having to underdeliver as a result.
Yes, very true.
You're a member of OSIA, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, as one of the directors, I feel I should put in a little bit of a plug there.
Yes, please do.
I found that I've got a lot of value out of OSIA from what I put into it, and the most amount of value I've got was from forming relationships with other businesses mm-hmm. and talking to them about the things that I can do and the things that we do, and them simply passing me leads, and I pass them leads. And that's been by far and away the most dollar value I've got out of it. So I'd strongly, you know, suggest everyone get involved from the point of view of just getting to know people in businesses and sharing their experiences, and you can get some real decent business out of it. So, thanks.
www.osia.org.au .net.au. Thank you. Whoops.
Do you have any specific strategies for dealing with expectations creep? And by that I don't mean expectations from creeps. I mean... when you especially when you over-deliver, they come to expect that, and then over time they expect more and more.
Very, very good question. If you're doing... The main problem I've had there has been in fixed-price work. If somebody says, we want you to build this system, you say it will cost this amount of money, expectations, features, everything else can sort of creep in there that you didn't expect. If you're doing things on a per-hourly basis, which is the only way I work now, which is wonderful, it's not as much of a problem. Because if they want you to code up something extra, that's fine. You code up something extra, they pay extra for it. But getting to that stage can be very hard. Because a lot of people want fixed price work, particularly non-technical people want fixed price work. And they don't understand that if they ask for something which does this, it doesn't mean something which does that, which is what they have in their mind. There's a very long discussion on this. I don't think I can do it now, but it has to do with software requirement specifications and everything else.
Hello, my name's Alistair. I run a business in Perth. Now, the problem I've found is that a large contact network doesn't necessarily do you any good if it consists of friends and geeks.
Yes.
You really do need contacts in business, and that is something that you need to get referrals and leads and such. How do you go about building a contact network in business if you don't know too many business people to start with?
Do a presentation, yes, was mentioned at the front, is actually a very good way to present to people.
Where do you present? Not an LCA.
Well,
I
present at LCA. My business is actually finding people who want to learn Perl. So LCA is a good spot to go to. Chances are people here may want to learn Perl, or they have got associates or friends or workmates who want to learn. So for me, it's a good place. Finding other people who are also running open source consultancies or working in the same area. OSIA is a good example. Talking to those people, saying, I have these skills. Hopefully you want to stand out in some way. And then it's the sort of secondary contacts is how I've done it. In getting contacts with real people, I talk to people on the bus because they can't get off the bus. It's between stops, so they're stuck there. Just keep talking to people until you find someone who says, oh, yeah, sysadmin, maybe. Hand them cards and so on. And I don't know beyond that, actually. I would actually ask Jacinta. Jacinta, who is up the front here, is the other half of Perl Training Australia. She does a fantastic job of networking and meeting people, finding clients. So I'd usually ask her to do it for me.
A bit over time, so the last question. Comment.
Actually, just to answer that question, if you are looking for contacts and network, there's a whole bunch of networking organisations. There's like Women in IT, there's a whole bunch of people starting new business, there's help from your various state governments, all to help you get over those kind of issues, because people who need people usually, because they're starting up businesses on their own, will also be there looking for someone like you.
Network forces, Chambers of Commerce, Rotary, Lions, all those other horrible.
Yes.
Sport's good.
Yes, sport is good. Charities are actually good as well. I got a lot of contacts through working with people who worked with charities early on. I think we're out of time, though.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you all very, very much.